Hello and welcome to Playback Daily. It's Wednesday, the 24th of April. I'm Louise Herity and here's some of what's coming up.
And it's normal to gain weight in pregnancy. You have to gain weight in pregnancy. But you know, eating for two is a bit of a misnomer. You do need an increased calorie intake, maybe about 300 extra calories in the second trimester, maybe up to 500 calories, extra calories in the third trimester.
It's nice to see Irish film being so celebrated everywhere.
But I think it's because the standard has gone up so much in the last few years.
I think so. We're a good little nation for that.
I have not been informed that we need any new additional laws. I do think, however, that we need to explore the potential for preventing people from being able to protest outside another person's home.
A DCU study has found that farmers face significant mental health issues compared to the general population, which includes suicide ideation, depression and anxiety. And the study also found that farmers are less likely to reach out for help. This morning, Shea Concannon, a farmer in County Galway, spoke to Oliver Callan about this and to share his own personal story.
Good morning.
How are you this morning? I know I'm conscious when you ring a farmer that they're always busy, always at something. What are you doing today?
I'm just at Fowler's Pearl now from missing the cows.
You're a dairy farmer?
I am a dairy farmer, yeah.
Very good. Now, straight away, the dairy farmers around the country are wondering now, how many is he milking?
50.
50? Oh, you're very generous. I thought it was like asking a woman their age, but you're milking 50. That's a busy farm to run.
It is busy enough now, yeah, to run it, yeah.
And I understand you lease your farm now.
Yeah.
As in you're the person renting the farm.
Yes, that's right. Because of what happened with my depression, I had to leave my home farm and I'm now on an intermittent farm.
You grew up on a family farm. I presume that's how everyone nearly ends up in farming.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And did you love farming when you're growing up, when it's thrust upon you?
Oh, get a choice? Yeah, I love farming. I was out in the farm since I was at 4 years of age. I was out in the farm.
Yeah, there's always a job for someone.
Always a job. Yeah, I loved it, yeah.
What are the best days that you remember growing up, and even when you became a grown man working on the farm, the best days as a farmer?
Well, I love the summertime when you're out and about and on the machinery and out in the field doing work. I did.
Just been outdoors all the time is the best.
Outdoors all the time, yeah.
Now, when did you notice that there was something kind of wrong in your life? It was wrong with the life that you were in.
It was probably back in 2012 when I just felt wrong. You know, I knew there was something wrong. I just wasn't myself, and I was finding it hard to do work. You know, I was just, everything was a struggle. So it was to get out up in the mornings and to get out and do work, and it just something. And then I got married in 2009, and my wife just knew there was something wrong with me. She just said, "Something wrong with you." She said, "We need to go to the doctor." So I went to the doctor, and straight away they said, "Yeah, you have depression, and do you want to get help?" And I said, "Definitely do."
You knew at that stage, you had been to the darker side, really, hadn't you? But before you
went to the doctor. I had been to the dark side. I was really bad for a couple of years before that. I didn't realise I had it for a long time.
When you're talking about those days when you had it and you didn't know, really, do you remember the conversations you might have with yourself?
Oh, yeah. I had myself convinced that there was no life in the tunnel, and that, you know, that my days were off. And I did go to the stage that I had my decision made that I was ending my life.
Right.
And I had just one evening I was gone getting the cow, bringing the cows in, and I was in the field, and I just said, "I can't do this anymore." And I decided to make a phone call to my sister to say goodbye, and she just talked me down. She said, don't do it, I'll get help. And she rang my wife, and between the two of them, they got the help. They got me to where I needed to be. And I talked out. I got to the doctor, and they brought me to see the nurses, and they just talked myself out, really. And I spent days going into the psych ward in Galway, and I just basically just talked, and they gave me basically ways to cope with it, and I'm out the other side of it now.
Well, well done on accepting the help and on going and getting the help. It must be, when you look back now, it must be still a frightening experience to remember.
Oh, yes, it definitely was. I mean, you know, especially families, they don't want to talk about it. And I didn't want to talk about it for a long time. But you know, it just, you need to talk. Talking is the only way you're going to get help and get the help you need and, you know, come out the other side of it. It doesn't have to be someone you know. You can talk to a complete stranger if it makes you feel better, you know, but talk to someone.
Yeah.
That's, you know, that's what it is, just and get the help you need. You know, but I know myself from since I had it, I seen an awful lot of farmers and they just don't want to talk. Not only farmers, but mainly farmers, they don't want to talk. They're afraid to admit they have a problem. But there's nothing wrong with admitting having a problem because there is help out there.
It's difficult for fellas to have that conversation.
It is. It is, yeah.
And there's something about being a farmer, because it can be a solitary work. I know even if you're in a family, you can spend long hours out in the fields on your own, can't you? With your thoughts.
Yeah, with my thoughts, that was the problem. I was always on my own, you know. I liked to be on my own. That's the way it was. I always wanted to be on my own, and I couldn't understand why. And that was some of the problem. It was just the way my mind was working. And it was really hard, sort of. And it got to a stage that I just couldn't cope anymore.
And there's no particular trigger, really, is there? Was there financial pressure? Were there issues?
No, it was just.
It's the illness.
It was
of
just over the, just feeling just over the years. It just got, was getting a bit worse and worse. I had taught upbringing when I was younger. I was sick, and I missed out on a lot of school as well. So that didn't help, and that just put extra pressure in my brain, and it all just built up, and yeah. It just, you know, just got went out of control then, in 2012. So it did.
It was an illness, and you needed
help. It was an illness, yeah.
What would you say to fellas out there? Because they're obviously reluctant to talk about many problems that go on in farms, and there's probably no harder job to have depression in than farming, because you simply have to get up every day. The cows have to be milked, or you're into serious trouble. What would you say to a fella who needs to make the first step to talk to someone?
Do it. Make the step. You know, I know it's tough, but you need to make that step. And I know the last couple of months have been tough on farmers now because of the weather. I mean, you know, it was tough on myself, but it really, the bad weather really makes people really get down and out.
For sure.
And the only thing you can do is talk to someone and just, you know, just open up and get out there and talk, because it will help. It will help.
And you're conscious, well, obviously you're saying that the terrible weather conditions we've had the last couple of months, very, very rough on farmers. You still have to look after your own mental health, obviously.
You do. You have to look after yourself. If you don't look after yourself, you can't look after the animals. That's the way it is, you know. And you know the weather was hard, but you have to look after yourself. Number one is yourself.
And what have you done to get through this winter? Is it chatting?
Yeah, I found a way of coping. I mean, coping is just, we've come to a stage that you just can't do anymore. Just stop what you're doing and sit down and just think and talk to someone and, you know, talk out the problems that you're seeing, and all that will help.
Yeah, and you find you're not the only one as well, I presume.
Oh, definitely. And as I said, there's an awful lot of people out there, and I know there is. And a lot of people, some people get help, but I know a lot of people don't want to get help because they're afraid to talk. You know? But unfortunately, that's life.
It is. MOCRA is a great organisation, and that was very helpful to you.
That was helpful to me when I was younger. Yeah, it helped me to get socialised and get out there, and it helped me a lot. Yeah.
And in more recent times, I think 2018, they piloted a mental health initiative, Make the Move, with two O's for obvious reasons, and that's something you got involved in.
Yeah, well, and my wife is involved in the Irish Cattle and Sheep Organisation as well, and
she
started up the Life Focus. You know, it was to do with mental health as well. And that she saw the way I was, that she needed to help other people. So she's a chairperson of that now. And she has helped an awful lot of farmers as well in the last year. They're almost into their lives.
Wow.
You know, so it's she's helping people and I'm helping people. So we're helping an awful lot of people in the last year now. Because of the weather, it's really putting under pressure.
It's really vital to now. That's your wife, Mona.
Yeah.
She sounds like a powerful woman.
She's a powerful woman, yeah, she is. Thanks to her, really, that I'm alive, because it was her that spotted that there was something wrong with me, because I didn't know what was wrong, and it was her that knew there was something wrong with me, and she brought me to the doctor and I got the help I needed.
And you love farming again now?
Oh, yeah, back again now. I love it, Lee, I love it. But there was a day when I was bad that I just existed, didn't know what to do, how to do. I was even finding it hard to do the work on the farm. And it took me about I suppose, nearly 2 years to get to it. Mm. But now I'm back again now and I'm flaming and loving it now again.
Even if it's not the summery the summer.
Oh
yet.
Yeah, I mean you have to take the weather as it comes. That's the way it is. And Farmers are actually, you know, they don't look at the bigger picture. You know, life is more important than the weather. The weather, you can't change the weather.
You can't,
unfortunately, you can't change the weather, but you can change your life.
There's a lot of other pressures from outside as well, isn't there? I mean, in this country particularly, we blame farming for climate change because of the emissions from agriculture, but you're not the only part of that whole machine.
No, that's right, yeah. I mean, there's an awful lot of pressure coming on farmers now from the department. The department has brought in an awful lot of rules and regulations that technically they don't need. And especially the older farmers, they don't know how to deal with the paperwork and to cope with the paperwork. There's an awful lot of extra paperwork now with grants and that, and it's putting an awful lot of pressure on farmers. And I don't think there's not a need for it.
The red tape. Well, they'll say there's a need for it, of course, you'll understand. But I can understand when it's older farmers and the pressure that puts on them, because they've just learned the previous thing and then a new one comes
along. And then the older farmers wouldn't be up to date with online paperwork, and most of it has gone online now. So that's putting a lot of older farmers under pressure as well, because they might have no one to do it for them. So then they lose out, and then that's putting more pressure on their head.
We have research from DCU, and I know that's the scientific study on mental health issues, but you anecdotally, in dealing with farmers, how do you think the state of their mental health is roughly at the moment?
I don't think it's great at the moment. As I said, there's farmers out there and they're not talking, and I know that there's farmers out there under a lot of pressure mentally and physically and probably financially as well, and they won't talk. And I'm worried about them because something's going to happen to them.
Well, you want to get them talking, Shay Kilcannon. Thank you so much for sharing your story, and we're delighted to hear you well. I know you have to look after your head all the time, and our best to Mona as well, who's doing great work. And to people who want to get in touch, obviously rt.ie/helplines will help people affected by this, but also Make the Move with two O's at mocra.ie is part of that initiative that programme that you're also involved in as well. We'll put those details up.
And my wife's in on Life Focus as well. She helps people as well in ICSA.
Shay Kilcannon, thanks a million and good luck. Look after yourself.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Galway farmer Shay Kilcannon on the Oliver Callan Show. And on the topic of farmers, potato farmers right across the country are finally out planting crops because the dry weather is continuing. And the adverse weather over the last few months means that farmers are now on the back foot and trying to make up for lost time earlier in the season, as Eddie Doyle, a potato farmer in South Kilkenny, told Claire Byrne.
Good morning, Claire. How are you?
You've taken a break for us, have you?
Just a very short one, Claire. Yeah.
So tell us, what is happening with you, and when did the planting start, and how's it all going?
We started about 4 or 5 days ago. We were obviously waiting for land to dry out, but Mother Nature has come good, and we're up and running, like, albeit look slowly, and you'd need an army to get everything done as quick as we'd like to get done in our heads. But anyway, we're getting there, I suppose, slowly, you know.
So what is the window for you now if the weather holds, and how much do you need to get done, say, in the next week or fortnight?
Well, look, it's as much as the weather will let us. You know, if it breaks again, it slows us back, like, which is normal for Irish weather. We're not guaranteed. I have a friend in the UK, and he can say he can do all his work, such a particular job, in 17 days, and he can nearly get it done every year in 17 days. But it could be, it can take us quite a bit longer because we the weather will be intermittent. But look, hopefully doesn't break too bad, because it would be, the spirits are finally lifting with farmers there because of the wet winter. Look, the spirits are lifting with everybody. Sure, it was dreadful. It doesn't matter who you were, a farmer or you were living in the middle of Dublin City. You need a bit of sunshine on your back, you know.
And how is the land now in terms of how dry it is?
Look, it's just adequate for working. Obviously, we work the drier fields first, which is what we're at, and the heavier land is probably just becoming workable at present. In this part of the country is all I could say. Probably around North Dublin, Mead, it will take another week perhaps before they would get really stuck into planting, you know.
And how far back are you now? You know, how much of a backlog are you dealing with?
Yeah, look, I suppose you know if you said an average of a month, you know, which is substantial in the growing season, considering
we need 130-140 days to grow a crop. Like, so if you take 30 days of that away, it obviously pushes you into later in the season to harvest, and there's no guarantees then. Like, but look, as we say, life doesn't have guarantees, and the weather certainly doesn't anyway, you know.
Yeah, so, well, of course.
So you're always working with the weather. That's the nature of farming. Mm-hmm. And, this year was more testing than quite a few. But look, I can remember back, and I can go back to when I started farming with my father here. We'd go back to the mid-80s, and we had a couple of dreadful springs as well, and followed by a very, very dry summers. And, you know, that tested everybody, but I suppose there was more of us in at that time. The load was spread around on more farmers, whereas we've less farmers now and with a lot more to do in a short window, like, mm-hmm. you know.
So do you expect now with the late planting start that the yield will be affected?
Ah, yeah, it would be somewhat. The yield curve, like, will drop dramatically once you get into May, you know, in potatoes, in everything, like the cereals. We have to have all those in, if possible, like by the end of end of April, early May, because yield will drop dramatically. Like, look, full yield potential is probably, we're gone past it anyway, but it's like everything, you have to try and limit the damage and get in your crops. But then there's no point in mucking in. I can't put in crops into poor conditions or you're guaranteed failure then, you know.
Yeah.
So,
well,
we have to have the land nice.
The growers who we've spoken to on the programme over the last few weeks said what's different about this year is you're coming off the back of a wet autumn into a wet spring, and that the harvest
No winter corn planted and very little winter crops. And
right.
The vegetable growers the same, like, you know, overwinter vegetable crops are scarce, and like with the vegetables, we need to be in quite early, and crops have to be staged to get them, get the crops coming in for the supermarkets, you know, in that you'll have weekly supplies, like, because nowadays, you know, years ago one particular grower grew a bit of early stuff, and yet another grower grew mid-season, and perhaps a different batch of growers grew winter stuff, but now every grower is probably specialised, and they have to grow nearly to supply the full season for their crop, and look, it brings its own pressures.
And your normal harvest,
a lot of pressure.
Your normal harvest would finish up towards the end of October, would it?
In potatoes, yeah. Look, that's always your hope. That when I would have been growing up to say to get the potatoes out of the ground before the 20th of October, and if not, definitely by the 5th or 6th of November, because the frost will come into play at that stage, you know, and cause you big problems. But look, it's as the days get shorter, look, it's everything gets that bit harder. But look, it no 2 years the same, Claire, you know, so we'll pray for that.
So listen, you're optimistic today, and you're in good form, obviously, because you can get out and do it. The only problem you have is the amount of work that you have to do in a short time frame.
Yeah, look, at a half hour machinery there. At the weekend, I had great help. I had lads off from college and school and chaps that helped me regularly. But we had everything moving, and it was mighty, you know. It's like the army here. But then Monday, after machinery was parked up. But sure, look, we'll get there nonetheless. You know, there is a labour shortage in farms, but no amount of help would probably get everything done this weather anyway. But the labour shortage is sure, it's all true.
Well, hopefully you get as much done as you can, and the rain stays away, Eddie, for another while. That's what you want, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, Claire. Look, as you know, probably one of our biggest problems, we have less growers. Like, we have very few vegetable growers left now, which I am one, and it has cut back. You know, there's a lot less to do to work, and like, you know, like scallions and stuff, like for instance, they're quite happy to bring in all the scallions from the other side, Mexico, like with obviously questionable quality assurance schemes. But the growers here, we've been decimated the last 15 years with you know, cut price promotions in supermarkets. And we've been warning all the time, please, geez, just give the growers a chance. Give us a chance to grow.
Yeah, well,
we're growing top quality produce, and we're nailed with quality assurance schemes that are very stringent by comparison to anything that would be on imported produce and yet not.
Well, and with climate change as well, it makes no sense, no logical sense.
Absolutely.
It would seem to be bringing things like scallions in halfway around the world. Eddie, we'll let you get back to it, because I know you're so busy today.
What we would be looking for going forward is support from the supermarkets and that to you know, to stock Irish produce. It hasn't. It's not been properly addressed.
Well, it's consumers like, as well. You know, it's us expecting to get the good deals. You know, we're buying the stuff at the end of the day.
It's the consumer can't be blamed because they have to live, and if they get stuff cheaper, we're not looking for the king's ransom. Vegetables and potatoes are, on the whole, quite cheap food. But if we have regular supply of Irish, it is very important, as you said, with climate change and food security. Mm-hmm. It's something that is on my mind the whole time that our industry has been brought to its knees, but we need the support of the supermarkets, we need the support of the regulator, and we need the support of the people supplying the supermarkets. And look at it, it'd be a great help. We've put through a serious winter, and if everybody doesn't stick together, it's not a great help, and that means the consumer needs to try and purchase Irish where they can.
All right, Eddie,
which is another problem.
Yeah, well, that's a good message to finish with.
Eddie Doyle, a potato farmer in South Kilkenny, on Today with Claire Byrne. At least 8 in every 10 people who arrive here seeking asylum have come through Northern Ireland, according to the Minister for Justice, Helen McEntee. Brian Dobson was joined by the Minister and had more on this on the News at 1.
Appearing before the Oireachtas Justice Committee last evening, the Minister claimed that more than 80% of international protection applicants now cross the land border, which she described as absolutely a challenge. Ms. McEntee defended the government's decision to opt in to the new European Union Migration Pact, designed to set EU-wide standards for refugee status and speed up decision-making on asylum applications. The Minister joins us now from our Dáil studio. Very good afternoon to you, Minister, and thanks
good afternoon,
for talking to us
Brian,
on the programme. So this figure of 80%, in fact, I think you told the committee it could be higher, of people arriving here seeking refugee status coming in through Northern Ireland. Is that a well-established pattern, or is it something that's emerged recently?
So this is a pattern, I suppose, that has changed over time. And that's something I think that people need to realise and understand, that migratory patterns and flows, people, the countries they come from and how they come, that changes over time. And we need to have a system that's flexible, that can respond, but that is coherent with the rest of Europe. And to your original statement, the issue of migration and asylum, this is not something that we can deal with on our own. This is not something that we should try to deal with on our own. We are at the moment, and we have been for the past 8 years, working with our European colleagues to essentially update the asylum and migration system that we currently have.
I do want to come to that. My question was, is this phenomenon, these large numbers crossing from Northern Ireland, is that something that's occurred fairly recently? I'm wondering, for example, is it maybe a result of the UK's Rwanda policy?
It's something that has changed over time. I think in particular since last year, you will know that we have implemented and I've made a number of changes to our overall system. So we have faster processing for people coming from particular countries. We've had a significant increase in the number of checks at our ports and airports. Mm. We now have work underway with airlines. So when you start to implement various different measures, you start to see changes in patterns and where people are coming from. So the number of people coming through our airports without documents has decreased significantly. The number of people coming from other countries through our airports have decreased significantly because of those changes. Mm-hmm. What we're now seeing is that the numbers are coming in a higher level through Northern Ireland. And there are a number of elements to that, I think. In particular, if I could just say, there was a decision taken recently by the High Court around particular readmissions. So in returning people to the UK, that in itself may have had an impact in particular in the last few months. But that is something that I will be addressing in the matter of weeks by changing our laws. So we have to be responding and reactive as these flows change.
And on that, and you've mentioned it already, we're proposing to sign up to this EU-wide migration pact. But it's a deal which is not going to cover those who are coming in through Northern Ireland, is it?
Well, so I suppose it covers things in a variation of ways. We have separate agreements with the UK. The UK are no longer in the EU, but because of our common travel area, because of the open border that we have separate agreements that mirror much of what we are doing in the pact and will mirror much of what will be done in the pact. That's in relation to returns. That's in relation to, I suppose, the communications that we have, the processing times that we have, and our ability to look at certain countries and respond in different ways. So we will have those agreements with the UK. But you also have a situation where you might have someone who has come through the EU. they have already gotten status, they go to the UK and then they arrive with us. So obviously that has implications in terms of the pact and our ability to return people to the EU.
Minister, there have been just under 7,300 people refused refugee status here since the beginning of last year, the beginning of 2023. How many of those have been deported?
So it is quite a small number of people have been physically removed. And I think it's important to stress that that's not where we actually want to be. What is the number? The number I'd say physically removed is less than 100. But what we need to stress is that it is not where we want to be in terms of physically removing people. Not only does that take much longer, not only is it much more costly, not only is it much more challenging, but it is less effective.
Out of 7,300, 100 have been deported. Where are the other 7,200?
So if you look at the system overall, if those approvals are just or negative decisions, which if I could say are a higher proportion than you would see across Europe, you have various different stages that then people can appeal. So this is one of the really important elements of the pact. So we have really improved our timeframes over the last number of years. You could have had people in the system for 6 or 7 or 8 years. We're now down to probably at a maximum around 2 years for many of the ordinary decisions. For those who are in accelerated procedures, their first decisions are within about 60 days. But we still have elongated appeals processes.
So if somebody is given a negative decision, it may be that they go through various different appeals, which do take time. So how many of those 7,200 are in an appeal process?
So you might have quite a high number of those in appeals. For those in accelerated processes, so for example, since we introduced it for the 10 countries last year, the safe countries, about 80% are given negative decisions. Those appeals then, on the appeals, about 80% are upheld. And what we're going to start to see now is, particularly with the faster processing, is that it will be much easier to remove people, but also they'll be removed much more quickly. Well, so you have to remember that we are completely overhauling the system that has for years taken years to actually even get to a deportation. Right. So we're trying to shorten that time.
People who are refused refugee status can appeal that decision to you, can't they? Isn't that correct? And you were asked by Michael McNamara in the committee yesterday how many of those appeals to you as minister are outstanding. Now, you didn't have an answer yesterday. Do you have an answer today?
So I don't have any appeals before me. I've not signed off on any appeals or refused or rejected any in the last year, at least. I know that we have a lengthy process, and this is why the pact is so important here. This is why it's important for people to understand what we would be bound by are changes that would reduce the time frame. So at the moment, we have our first appeals. We have people's ability to appeal beyond that, and it elongates the process.
Yeah.
So
if I can just focus on this measure, the provision that someone can appeal to you, and I'm quoting from your own documents provided by the department here, you cannot appeal a deportation order to IPAT, it says. You can make a request to the Minister for Justice for a deportation order to be revoked. Now, how many such requests have been made to you since the beginning of last year?
I've not signed off on any of any requests since the beginning of last year.
No, I didn't say signed off on. How many requests have been made to you? Maybe their decision is pending. How many are outstanding? That was the question from Michael McNamara.
So I can't give you that figure, but if they haven't come before me, then I don't have a figure to be able to give you. They haven't come before me, therefore they haven't like that. In terms of the overall number, I haven't signed off on any in the last year. So that shows you there's very few that are coming anywhere near me if I haven't signed off on any in the last year. What I'm trying to say, though, is that our overall system, we can focus on deportation orders, which actually has minimal impact. And I have to be clear, and that's not just Ireland, it's right across the EU. The most important thing is that we give people a negative decision straight away. Nobody wants a deportation order because not only does it follow them here when they're in this country, but if they go to any other European country. So what you want is a person getting a negative decision early on, that they're given the option to remove themselves. And if they don't, then they are forcibly removed. But it is much quicker. It is easier. It is a much better process where people are returned, supported to return where they're coming from, instead of a physical deportation order.
The existing system, the Dublin system, I think it's called, allows for asylum applicants to be transferred by agreement to another EU country. Now, Ireland has transferred, we learned yesterday, 3 people last year, 2 in 2022. Why so few?
Well, firstly, it's a system that isn't working and isn't effective. And there's two elements to it. Firstly, the 188 figure is only half of what we had actually requested. So countries are able to. So if we, for example, request Spain to take back somebody and they decide not to, it's very difficult for us to appeal that or to change it. You also have other countries who simply stopped taking people back. Right. So the 188 figure is only half. Then within that, you have
There were 188 agreements to transfer, were there not, with other countries?
There are, but within that then, so an agreement doesn't mean that somebody's automatically removed. There are appeals, there are various different stages in between that approval and then us actually being able to remove them. And what I'm saying and what I've said very clearly is that it doesn't work and our system doesn't work. So by joining the pact, not only will we have a faster turnaround time and an ability to be able to deal with all of what we need to deal with before we can actually remove somebody, more of the onus will be placed on the country to do that work when we ask them to take them back and when we tell them. So that is the difference here. The onus is not is placed on the other country as opposed to now where the onus is placed on us and where we have been in a very short space of time gone from dealing with 3,000 cases to 13,000 cases in 1 year. So we are ramping up our system, but we need to keep ramping it up.
Okay, before I let you go, the question of the policing of protests that's arisen following the demonstration at Roderick O'Gorman's home last week. Now, the Taoiseach was saying earlier this week that he wants to know if existing laws are robust enough, and if they are, then he needs to know if Gardaí are empowered enough to enforce them. He wants, if I can quote him, "I want clarity on a very simple question. Is this a matter of enforcement or a matter of law? Which is it?"
Well, look, I've spoken to the Gardaí Commissioner quite a number of times since last week. I'm meeting him again today. We have very clear laws that are there. We have public order laws. We have offences against the person laws. We have road traffic laws. There are many laws that are available to police these protests. And we need to make it very clear. The Commissioner last week in his direction to his teams have made it clear that these laws need to be used. And I am very clear that we cannot have, whether you're a public representative or not, we cannot have anybody intimidated in their home, at their place of work, or some of the protests.
The question
we have
is
seen,
the law,
we need to make
is the
sure
law
that the
adequate
Gardaí
to
are
the
using
task?
It.
Do the Gardaí have the powers they need?
I have asked this question. I have made it very clear that if they need to change, then I need to be informed of that. I have not been informed that we need any new additional laws. I do think, however, that we need to explore the potential for preventing people from being able to protest outside another person's home. So that is one area that I think we do need to develop further. But in terms of public order, in terms of offence against the person, in terms of road traffic incidents or laws, they are there, they are very clear, and I think they need to be implemented.
Minister for Justice Helen McEntee chatting to Brian Dobson on the News at One today. On Today with Claire Byrne, a discussion about the role played by a GP during pregnancy continued today with a focus on the later stages of pregnancy and labour. And the host was joined by Clare-based GP Dr. Maura Finn.
Hello, good morning to you.
Lovely to have you with us again. So we'll talk about general advice, first of all, during this time. So it's the second and third trimester we're discussing really at this point. Nutrition is always something that comes up as soon as we start talking about pregnancy. So what's important to remember about the later stages and nutrition?
It's literally the same as in the early stages. It's about maintaining your optimum nutrition. So it's about making sure you have those essential vitamins that are very important in pregnancy. So that would be folic acid, vitamin D, calcium. So through your diet is far better than anything else. So like good, maybe three servings of dairy in a day, oily fish, high protein foods, low fat, low sugar, low salt. But then the other thing that really kind of can tax a lot of women's minds is about eating for two and increased calorie intake and that worry about weight gain. And it's normal to gain weight in pregnancy. You have to gain weight in pregnancy. But eating for two is a bit of a misnomer. You do need an increased calorie intake, maybe about 300 extra calories in the second trimester, maybe up to 500 calories, extra calories in the third trimester. So it is normal to need to have more food. More fluid is really important as well, because think about it, you're making all this fluid around the baby as well. So you get dehydrated quite easily. So they're the most important things. Not to stress about it, but make sure what you're taking in is really good quality nutritional food. and avoid smoking, avoid alcohol, and reduce your coffee, tea intake, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to ask you about the types of checks that GPs will be doing around this time in the second and third trimester. But this listener has taken us very nicely into this because she's telling us that she's 32 weeks pregnant and checks her blood pressure from time to time. It's been elevated for the last 2 days with no other symptoms. And she'd like to know, when do you recommend you should go to the doctor or the emergency department even to get it checked out? What do you say?
Okay, so what should be happening, and for this lady, 32 weeks, she should be having a checkup between the hospital and her GP every 2 weeks at this stage. And if there is anything outside of the norm, that's a guideline. It's not an absolute. So if she's concerned in any way, she calls her GP and she goes and gets checked. Now, when she says her blood pressure has raised a little bit, it could be a very little consequence. And very often you're starting from a low base because in early pregnancy, your blood pressure tends to drop. But if her blood pressure is anything over 140 over 90, that would be something significant. And we check that routinely in every visit. But what we're looking for is elevation of blood pressure in itself, but also a condition called preeclampsia, which is where you have elevated blood pressure, protein in your urine, and maybe swelling. You may have swelling in your face or your ankles, your hands, you know. Now, a little bit of swelling is normal. We'll all remember not being able to get rings on and off, especially if the weather is hot. That's normal in pregnancy. But if it's outside the norm, then we worry about it. So our checkups, which this lady will be having, and if she goes to her GP today, which is what I think she should do, is a blood pressure check, checking her urine, checking the baby, checking her ankles and hands and make sure there isn't too much edema, and having a listen to the baby and making sure everything is fine. But if there's any concern, straight into the hospital, because preeclampsia is something that can really cause difficulty for the baby and the mother, and it's one of the leading causes for bringing on early labour in especially in first time mothers.
Okay, so that woman you're saying should get in touch with the GP today about that.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so in general then, the checks that the GP will be doing over this time, particularly in the later stages, Maura.
So a urine, it does seem a bit strange. We become a bit obsessed with your urine when you're pregnant. So you always have to have a urine bottle in your back. But we check the urine for lots of different reasons. Number one, urinary tract infections are more common in pregnancy. We also look for protein, like I just mentioned. That's very important about preeclampsia. We look for sugar because it could be a sign of gestational diabetes. We look for signs of blood that could be, you know, a sign of something else or a discharge that might be developing. So a urine test is always needed. Blood pressure check is always needed. And then we check the baby. Some people weigh mammies. I don't tend to anymore because it is very little value from a medical point of view. It used to be of value before scans were available just to see about baby's growth and stuff. But we're checking that by checking the tummy anyway. And I have to say, antenatal visits are usually just the nicest thing because they're usually confirming that everything is going well. You're listening to a fetal heart, which that never grows old. I mean, I still, every time I hear it, I just think that's such a privilege to be able to hear a baby's heartbeat. And some mammies will record that or have their partner aim at them. And it's a lovely thing to do. Mm-hmm. We also have time then to develop a relationship with the mother and answer questions that they may not be able to ask anybody else, and frequently things about like how they'll manage or will I be a good mum, you know, all those things that we all instinctively feel. And I actually often feel that kind of natural anxiety or concern around pregnancy and about motherhood is such an important development step, because if you go into pregnancy and going into having a baby and you think it's going to be you're going to fly through it and it's going to be fine, they tend to be the people to get a big gland. You know, having a certain amount of worry about it is essential and normal.
Very
but
normal,
allowing
yeah.
yourself to talk about it is what's really important.
Now, this is from Kate, who is expecting twins.
Oh, wow. And, well done, Kate.
would like to know if she should plan for more GP visits for a twin pregnancy than she did with her first, which was a single pregnancy, and are there extra precautions to take? Now, she's given us some details. The twins are paternal. They're in separate sacs and placentas, etc.
Okay. Either way, yes, absolutely. And what will happen naturally with the hospital situation is that she will be kind of put in as kind of a more complicated pregnancy. So she will be put into a different sector. So the first time around, you know, first pregnancy, you always get a certain amount of visits. For second pregnancy, if it was a single pregnancy, it's actually kind of a little bit more relaxed. But she'll be back in the you know, high risk pregnancy. Now, I'm not saying that to freak her out, but it actually is true with twin pregnancies or any multiple pregnancy. There's always a risk of every complication risk is heightened, and particularly early term delivery. So, you know, when you get twins beyond 35, 36 weeks, you think that's great. They've actually nearly full term. So that's significantly earlier than actual term, which is 40 weeks. So you do expect her to deliver early. You do expect her to have more complications with blood pressure. So more frequent visits in the hospital and the GP would be an absolutely normal way to go. Okay. But she's not to overly worry. I mean, it's hopefully going to work out really, really well for her, and it's a wonderful experience. But it's just to be that more cautious. And she may need to, if she's working, she may need to consider stepping away from work a little bit sooner as well.
Okay, and that might just be something she'll have to do. You know, it mightn't be a choice depending on the job that you have. It just might be difficult physically to keep going.
Any job, like, I mean, even, you know, obviously kind of very physically active jobs are difficult, but even if you're sitting all the time, that's very difficult. You get very stiff when you're sitting in pregnancy. One of the big things, if you are in any job that you're sitting a lot, get up and move around as much as you possibly can. And that reduces your risk of varicose vein development, and then the swelling in the ankles and stuff. But God, it's hard. But twin or multiple pregnancies, working beyond 32 weeks, I think, is really difficult.
Okay. Can we move towards the labour stage? And how do you feel about birth plans and people who come up with this plan that they expect to work out? And oftentimes, I'm sure, doesn't, because things change as you go through labour.
Yeah, I think it's a really good idea. I think it's a great idea to kind of have an active plan in your head as to what might happen, particularly in the early stages of labour, when those stages in the first, what we call the first stage of labour, when you're kind of the beginning of between contractions and when you're fully dilated. And the more you move around, and, you know, if you want to be in water, if you want to be kind of using a birthing ball, using your partner, whatever it is, that's really good. And talk to your midwife, talk to your friends, do some research online, do all of that. But the one thing I would say is that these are often aspirational. And if you have very strict ideas of what your perfect scenario would be, it very frequently doesn't work out like that. And that's nobody's fault. It's because the outcome is to have a healthy baby and a healthy mommy. And sometimes interventions are needed. So if somebody comes in with a birth plan and says, I will not have a cesarean section, for instance, well, nobody wants you to have a cesarean section, but it may be that your baby is in distress and you've been in labour for so many hours that nothing is happening and somebody has to intervene. So, you know, you cannot have these kind of like lines where you will not cross, because, you know, safety is the ultimate goal here. But I do think they're a really good idea. I think, you know, you have to just think of them as being aspirational and you take advice from the medical people.
You have to expect the unexpected. Have your plan, yes. But you've got to, you know, understand that things can change. Right, another listener question. I'm expecting a second baby in early June. I'm wondering about when to call the hospital in labour, particularly with a subsequent pregnancy. So how many contractions, how often, etc. This listener says our firstborn came via scheduled induction, so no experience. If it matters, we live about 40 to 60 minutes drive from the maternity hospital. We may need to factor in time to get our toddler to granny and granddad. Oh, these are all the things you think about, isn't it?
Isn't it? That's exactly what most people are dealing with, isn't it?
Yeah.
And actually, no two deliveries are the same. You know, that's the thing. You know, she doesn't have any kind of concept of what, you know, the that kind of film-based thing, you know, the waters break and you run into hospital. She doesn't know what that's like. What the midwives will say to you is that you should be having a contraction that lasts about up to a minute and about 5 minutes apart and getting stronger. But if that, you know, that's not an absolute. Nothing is an absolute in medicine. I mean, apart from, you know, that 40 to 60 minute drive, that's a concern. Now, the majority of people will have a drive of some sort. Managing, how do you get the toddler to the granny and granddad? Will they come to you? You know, all of those things. They're hard to manage too. And there's an awful lot of fear about going into the hospital, being told nothing's happening and being sent home. And women hate that. But I would say you're better to go in and be sent home again than miss the opportunity and have something happen on a motorway or have something happen and have a complication that happens because you're not in the hospital. The other things I would say, if you've a bleed or your Lycor has gone, if your waters are broken, you should go in. It doesn't really matter about, you know, bleed absolute in there straight away. But even with the waters, go in, don't wait for the contractions, because you can have the waters gone and contractions may take a while to come. But there's a risk of infection ascending into the baby if the waters are broken. So that's some, that is a reason to actually attend. But there's no absolute, and ring the hospital if she's not sure.
Mm-hmm. A quick one here on flying. So this listener has a very close friend's wedding in the UK when she will be 33 weeks pregnant. Is it safe to fly?
You see, that's okay. The UK, the guidelines are, you know, if it's a short flight, anything shorter than 3 hours, you really can fly up to 38 weeks. Long haul flights beyond 4 hours, 36 weeks. But they're in absolute necessities. The problem is, even with a short flight, what if you go into labour in the plane? What about the healthcare wherever you're going to? What if your symptoms are usually exaggerated in a plane too, the swelling, the heat, the discomfort. Your risk of a DVT, which is a clot, mm-hmm. is heightened in pregnancy anyway and in long-haul flights. So really, it really depends on the circumstances. But I would say with the UK, 33 weeks, if she has no other complications, she's probably fine to go.
Maura,
and should enjoy
you.
It.
Dr. Maura Finn on Today with Claire Byrne. Navan-born actor, writer and producer Claire Birmingham, who is based in LA and whose award-winning short movie Red Lake is available to watch on RTE Player, joined Oliver Callan for a chat today.
We are very proud of it and so happy that it's getting the exposure and the global audience. So it's really nice. It's nice to see Irish film being so celebrated everywhere.
But I think it's because the standard has gone up so much in the last few years.
Yeah. We're a good little nation for that.
We used to kind of go, well, that movie looks like an Irish film.
Right.
Whereas now you can no longer tell. The production standards, I think, I don't know if that's fair to say, you're in the world.
I think so, absolutely. And at the same time, Ireland is such a beautiful landscape and there's so much rich history and mythology. So I think with our production, it's a bit of a mix of Irish mythology meets maybe American Horror Story, or that's the goal at least. We do want to develop this into returnable series.
Yeah.
So I think even having it, I'm excited to see the reception from the American audiences next week and kind of have those conversations about what's possible.
It reminds me a bit of the Watchers. Well, the novel was called The Watchers. It's been turned into a film from the Shyamalan,
family of horror directors. Yeah.
And it's shot in the west of Ireland.
That's right.
Thereabouts, it's coming out this year as well. And
it has
that sort of, something's not right here.
Yeah.
But in a very Irish, kind of, very Irish scary story.
Right, yeah.
So tell us what you're up to. You obviously, you're in Navan. And we were talking to a farmer this morning. And I gather your parents they all came from farming backgrounds, as you mentioned.
Yes, the good old farming background,
so
yeah.
That feature in your childhood?
It did a bit, yeah. On my mom's side, my granny, they would have been sheep farmers and mixed crop farmers. But yeah, I do remember my granny gave my brother and I our own lamb.
Your own lamb, really?
To feed with the baby bottle and everything.
Yeah.
So I just hope we didn't eat it.
I think you were being taught a lesson at the time, Claire. That's the only reason that granny would give.
Yeah, we took good care of it at the time anyway. So
but they're delicious. Well, come here. Were you dreaming away on the farms? I know you're visiting your grandparents. Obviously, you're in Navan, dreaming away of the bright lights of Hollywood.
Yes. Well, I mean, I suppose I always knew I wanted to get into acting and performing. I was always a bit of a performer, but the plan to move to LA didn't really happen until I was studying drama at Trinity, and then.
Yeah.
I won a scholarship in my third year to go to University of California.
Oh, right. So from Trinity, you got... Okay.
Yeah. And I'd never been to America before. I kind of had thought maybe I'd go the London route or,
Many do, yeah.
But once that happened, it was my first time in America. I was exposed to the industry there and I just fell in love with it. Also, I was in California, so the sun was shining. The beach was there. So I knew that this... it would, you know, it's a challenging industry anyway. So I thought, I mean, may as well struggle in the sunshine.
Challenging is one way of putting it. I mean, it's the impossible industry in many ways, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, and then even, you know, I had to come back to Ireland to finish my degree.
Yeah.
And then even just the process of figuring out how can you actually go to America legally with the visa and everything to start the career. You know, for Americans, if they want to, they can just pack up their car and drive to Hollywood. But if you are from anywhere else in the world, you have to
have your place to go to America.
Yeah, they have a lovely title on that visa as well. The Alien of Extraordinary Ability.
Is that what they call it? Yeah. Well, that's the actor's visa.
Yeah, for actors. And it's also for athletes and scientists.
Yeah.
But
Aliens of Extraordinary Ability. It's a good name for a film, actually.
Yeah, it's a good one to say over a cocktail.
Yeah. And Camille, you went out there and you obviously to come back to college. Were you thinking, this is an impossible town to make it? I'm not. Who can make it here?
When I came back to college,
I
said, "Oh, I'm going there. That's the plan." And so I was determined. I was decided. I was going to get that visa. It wasn't until I think I actually arrived in Hollywood that I thought, "Oh, this is a lot."
Yes, okay.
Because I was quite sheltered. Obviously, even too, when I was studying, I was in the university program and I wasn't going out auditioning and doing the grinds. But then when I moved there, after I finished my degree, I was so excited to move. I didn't even walk in my graduation. As soon as the graduation ceremony, my dad was laughing at me. He's like, "Geez, Claire, you were ready to go." But then, yeah, when I hit the ground there, I'd say I had to grow up faster my first year in LA than probably seven before. It is a tough town. I mean, it's amazing when everything is great, but and it's huge. I mean, LA is the population, I think, of Ireland itself.
It's hard to believe, isn't it?
It is, I mean, crazy.
Some of us will know from going on holidays there, and it's a strange place because I think this is a weird thing to say, but it doesn't seem to have any footpaths. Nobody walks anywhere. And if you don't get on a bus because that's a sign of absolute poverty.
Oh, yeah.
So you have to drive everywhere. And consequently, they tend to have a different view on drink driving than we do.
Yeah.
It's a crazy town.
It is crazy. And you see that in the movies and everything too. Yeah. You know, they have a couple of drinks and then they drive off.
Yeah.
But yeah, and I mean, my dad had given me some driving lessons before I left. But essentially, no, I learned my driving chops in LA, which was frightening.
So you totally just have to become independent instantly,
like,
don't you?
Here we go.
You go to LA.
Yeah.
So it's beautiful. You've got blue skies and everything. How inaccessible is the Hollywood with the capital H?
The industry. I think I would describe it as a cross between a Jenga pile and a Monopoly board. You know, it's... because there are many things that you can do and steps that you can take to approach it. But it's not like, you know, a career in the entertainment industry doesn't have, you know, you can get your degree and everything, but it doesn't guarantee anything. So,
of course, yeah.
And what works for one person isn't going to work for another. So I think you have to have a really strong sense of self. And I definitely learned my street smarts in LA too, because you can have all the drama classes in the world, but you need to know how to deal with people. And
what are the street smarts? Is that the confidence thing that you
confidence have to and you know I suppose just the networking part of it, that definitely is a thing, you know, meeting people, surrounding yourself with the right people, and everyone's an actor, of course, so you have to be aware of all of the professional pretenders.
So you have to go to events and things, do you, to
definitely
swan about?
Yeah, and there's so many different ways. I mean, you know, getting an agent, getting a manager, getting in the guild, and then, yeah, going to networking events. And also, I thought I was great, you know. It's like, oh, I don't need to take any... I have a degree from Trinity, and then I got there and it was then, you know, you're not acting that right for camera.
We don't care.
Be upset, but make it look nice, you know.
Nice, wow.
So all, you know, all these different classes, multicam, single cam, soap opera, procedural, and all of these things that I would have had no experience with. But actually those studios, I think, acting studios, the reputable ones, again, there's plenty of people that'll be happy to take your money.
Oh,
but
right.
they
yeah, yeah.
were um, they're great sources of community. So I think, you know, you're then...
This is training-wise, so you pay...
Yeah, well, no, and in LA, you know, I think when you're, once you're there, for any young actor that's going out there, anyone, you know, like me, who's getting started, it's a great place to connect with other people and make friends. And then people are, you know, now creating a lot of their own materials. So it's a great way to collaborate and kind of make sure you're moving in the right circles. Yeah.
It was, you were undaunted by this, obviously, because I can see from your CV, sorry, your resume, that you have oodles of credits, particularly loads of theatre in America, which I would thought would be very difficult to get into as well. And people, we will see you in Harry Wilde, which is made here, obviously, but it's all coming from Hollywood. But I'll come back to your stuff in a moment. But you've done this very interesting thing where you've set up thinking about people like you who are going out for the first time. What is that business? It's called
Access America. Yeah. So actually, when I got my green card after 3 years of being in the States, and that was a big achievement. You know, it came through my work that I'd done there. And so it was my dad's idea, actually. He said, you know, Claire, you should set up a seminar or a consultation, or you should tell people how you did it, because I met so much, you know, kind of backlash or negativity about it even being possible to get the visa. Because even if you do go on the USCIS website, it will give examples of evidence that you need, and the examples are Academy Award or BAFTA, and kind of thing. Well, I don't have one of those.
Don't have one yet.
Okay. Yet. Yeah. So basically, it's a seminar, and I present it here at the different universities and conservatoires, and also around the world, and privately, and basically just demystifying the process of what is necessary.
So important. Such a great idea.
Yeah, and it's been really great, and it kind of brings things full circle, and just to kind of encourage people that it is possible, and especially if they don't, you know, people can have a dream but they don't know how to attack it, maybe.
Of course, yeah.
So
it's, or where to begin.
Yeah.
So you're helping with visas and things. So the O-1 entertainment visa, which of course you mentioned, finding an immigration lawyer, that's the thing you have to do.
Well, yeah, and that was probably one of the biggest challenges. I think when I came back from that year in California, I probably spent more time trying to find a good lawyer than working on my thesis, because, you know, they have to be American and...
Jeepers.
And how do you know, you know? So I did a lot of research, and the law firm that I work with Access America, are the same people that got me my visa, my green card, and now I'm a dual citizen. So I'm only speaking from first experience, so I feel confident.
Are you offering a kind of a package to people, a sort of a do-all package, or how does it work?
Depending what people need, you know, whether it's just information about the process, or whether it is linking them with the legal team, or whether, and then also it can go further. And
yeah, I like the further bit, because you're... yeah. So I'm now, let's assume I'm 22 years of age coming over, because I presume it's a shallow place where age matters.
It is, yes.
Or at least have to look like a bin bag full of fists or whatever, ripped in that way. Establishing yourself among the industry in Hollywood, there's the agent manager and stuff like that. You can do that for people.
Yes, and so I think that was a lot of the stuff that I kind of found out through trial and error on my own, what studios to maybe take part in, what they have different showcases, or when should you join the union, or how do you approach getting an actor or manager.
Amazing.
And,
actually,
you know, even what kind of places you should be hanging out, you know.
And that was Claire Birmingham on The Oliver Callan Show, and you can watch her movie Red Lake on RTE Player. And that's all we have time for on this edition of Playback Daily. So from me, Louise Herity, thanks for listening and take care.